Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Hello, and welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. I have another great guest for you, as always, focused on the volunteer state and our nation today. With always an interesting person making a positive change in our community, this time special guest, constitutional rights attorney, Larry Crane. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere you get your podcasts at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. And don't forget to subscribe to the show so you won't miss a single episode. And thank you for listening. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Larry Crane. Larry L. Crane of Brentwood, Tennessee, is a nationally recognized constitutional lawyer and frequent lecturer and commentator. He has litigated, debated, and practiced widely in the area of constitutional law and human rights. Crane's concern for First Amendment issues, particularly the rights of individuals to be free of religious discrimination, led him early in his legal career to serve as general counsel for the Rutherford Institute and later as senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, where he litigated a broad spectrum of constitutional issues on a national level before the United States Supreme Court, the 3rd, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 9th Circuit Courts of Appeal, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, the Supreme Court of North Carolina, and the Supreme Court of our beloved Tennessee. His litigation experience on issues of constitutional law spans 26 states. Crane's victories in the area of constitutional law and civil rights have been the subject of numerous newspapers, magazines, and television profiles ranging from CNN, Inside Edition, Fox News, The New York Times, Washington Post, Good Morning America, ABC News, and NBC News, as well as several international newspapers. In 2012, his concern over the legal issues facing churches and religious ministries led him to found the Church Law Institute, a nonprofit legal and educational ministry serving churches across the United States. Today, CLI is providing vital legal services to churches in states all across the United States. Born in 1955 in Tennessee, Larry L. Crane earned a Bachelor's of Science degree from Vanderbilt University in 1976 and a Juris Doctorate degree from the Nashville School of Law in 1980. He's married to Florence and has 4 children and 7 grandchildren, last I heard. Hello, Mr. Crane. I know how incredibly busy you are, so thank you for coming on the Mill Creek View podcast with me today. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Steve, and thank you so much for having me with you today. These are obviously interesting times that we're living in.
Absolutely, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. I have a lot of questions for you and your amazing career in law. There's no way I'll get to them all in one sitting, but let's try. But first, let's get into some backstory. Way back in 2014, you defended a pharmacist that was fired for conscientiously objecting to selling morning after pills. What do you make of pharmacists now that won't fill ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine prescriptions? That should be a felony, shouldn't it, for not filling a doctor's orders?
Absolutely should. We've had a number of cases, especially during the COVID pandemic, when we had actually tragic situations occur. People could not, even though they were prescribed these medications on occasion, they were not allowed to get to them. Pharmacists turned them away. We had one or two cases where people actually died as a result.
Aren't the major chains like CVS and Walgreens in big trouble? I mean, it's very ironic. Your client was fired for not filling, and now they are asked from their bosses to not fill.
Precisely. The irony is here that they will prescribe medications designed to terminate life early, but will not honor prescriptions from doctors who say that this is needed to preserve their life.
Terrible, terrible term. Okay, well, thank you for that. So fast forward to today. It's a great story Tricia Lucente tells and told us here in episode 7. Hope everyone goes back and listens about how you took her and Parents' Choice Tennessee's case on behalf of Tennessee parents. I'd love to hear your side of that story. What made you take that case?
Well, this is an issue. I think that the last count, there were 42 different states that had some measures involving critical race theory or Common Core teachings in our public school. There have been a number of lawsuits filed in other parts of the country, but none here in Tennessee, to my knowledge. And we've got just a very blatant case of violation here in our home state, and particularly, I think, 35 or 36 school districts across the state that are teaching a curriculum called Wit and Wisdom, and that on its face is a violation of critical race theory doctrines and also Common Core. So we felt it was time. These courageous parents came forward. Ms. Lucenti, who I wish all my clients were as polite, studious, and conscientious as she and her husband have been.
They are great people, yeah.
Great people. They mobilized about 1,400 families across Tennessee and the country to become a part of their organization called Parents' Choice. And it's still doing a great work, and I predict we'll accomplish greater things as they grow. But this was an issue that every attempt had been made to address this informally. The school board was simply turning a deaf ear, and so they had no choice but to hire counsel and to file this lawsuit.
Now, you were just in trial for this last week, and in Tennessee, we have what's called divisive concepts appeals process. What is that, and why do you say it's biased?
Well, it's biased for a number of reasons. First of all, it's futile when you've got, as in this case, we've got evidence showing that all of those who would be making a decision or ruling on their administrative appeal have already gone public to say that there's no problem, that Wit and Wisdom doesn't violate the law. And they have scorned or laughed at parents who attempt to raise their concerns about their children. And so those are the people who are the final arbiters over whether or not these parents' claims would be adjudicated properly. And they're clearly biased. And so couple that with the fact that it takes, in some cases, just by statute, over 300 days to get a ruling. That's 300 days from the time they file the complaint until it's finally ruled upon by the commissioner. And so as I argued to the court last week, justice delayed is justice denied.
That's a whole school year, 365 days. So yeah.
And if you've got other children coming along the system, you've got to renew it all over again.
So Penny Schwinn is the final arbiter under the process. Why is the governor-appointed supervisor of schools issuing Wit and Wisdom waivers?
Well, you know, the whole circumstance, the circumstances surrounding Penny Schwinn has been a bit of a mystery from the beginning. Why our governor would appoint someone with whose husband, by the way, is vested in this whole industry, worked many years with the very curriculum provider that published Wit and Wisdom. And so we know where her loyalties lie. Yes, she's the one who gets to make the final word on this. She has gone through quite a bit of scrutiny through our General Assembly as a consequence of these waivers that she granted to these school districts to use this flawed curriculum.
So why do you think Wit and Wisdom, or what everyone else calls CRT or racist indoctrination, but in Williamson County, it's Wit and Wisdom, is something that needs a legal challenge? It's a lot like last year's Williamson County mask mandate. A judge ruled it was illegal, but they kept it going. Why do they die hard with masks and the 14 illegal school curriculum items after a judge said stop?
This is an area of law that oftentimes is plagued with procedural hurdles, and parents who have who want to raise concerns of this type are often met with standing issues or arguments that are of a very technical nature. Parents' Choice, being an advocacy organization, was met with the same arguments as those who formed groups to oppose the mask mandate. So. I think that the issue oftentimes is that parents can't navigate to get to the merits of their case because they're met instantly with these procedural niceties that the school boards like to throw at them. In this case, we decided to do this a little differently, and a very comprehensive complaint was filed. I think it was at last count, it was about 176 page complaint. And we laid it out with dozens of illustrations in the lawsuit itself of how this particular curriculum violates not only the prohibited concept statute, but also Common Core. I think we've got, we argued the case last week. I think we've got an excellent record if the judge should find that there is, some technical defense that he's relying on.
So you've obviously seen the material. For those that haven't, what have you seen that is so offensive?
Well, the age appropriate or inappropriate nature of a lot of this material is most disturbing. You've got first and second graders learning about, death and suicide and massacre in very graphic terms, and then not so subtle attempts to lay the blame for those horrific events on a race-based bias that the reason why Native Americans suffered such horrific injuries because of the evil nature of the white man's approach to dealing with that cultural issue.
Certainly not something that children should have to worry about. It's hard enough to get them to sleep if they see the commercial for a scary movie, much less 8 hours of schooling. When I reported on the sex ed stuff in my newspaper, millcreekviewonline.com, in Washington state, it was pornographic. This was 3-4 years ago. The industry for sex ed books and in-class films has exploded since then. Like I said, 2015, so even longer. How bad is it now?
I have over the course of my career represented parents in a number of issues. I remember some years ago being in Massachusetts, and they had seventh and eighth graders who were being handed out condoms in this middle school. Just last week had parents in my office showing me excerpts of a book that they're, in this case, it was high school, but as you say, it was just blatantly obscene and pornographic, talking about the graphic account of a rape of a young girl. When I think I have seen the worst, Steve, it gets worse.
I think back when I was a kid, if they did hand out condoms, or some schools are putting feminine napkins in boys' locker rooms, we would have used those as like spit wads, throw them around. It was certainly not to create a lifestyle. Now, Penny Schwinn, she got a letter from the Department of Education basically threatening our state with consequences for being not in compliance with the title, I forget what it is, four maybe, rules linked to ESSL money. How can a deputy at Department of Education reach into our state and demand things? Isn't that unconstitutional?
Well, it certainly violates the tenet of our constitutional concepts that states, and in particular local governments, have the broad discretion and final say over educational programs and curricula and other matters. This is, the U.S. Department of Education has traditionally shown deference to the local LEAs, the local educational agencies, and they are the ones who we vote into office. They are the ones who we look to make those types of decisions. The all-powerful federal government's threat to withhold funds is a powerful weapon.
So is your fight with Williamson County, is it with school boards? Is it with the federal government? Is it with Governor Lee and the state? Who are we fighting when we used to be school boards in counties, in cities?
Yeah, you start with the concept that it is the parent. It is the parent constitutionally and fundamentally who has the right to direct and control the education of their children. And I know you've heard these arguments before, but it is still true that children and parents do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. And their rights preempt that of the local government and indeed the federal government.
Certainly do in communist countries. And the NEA, the AFT, and the NAIS, even American School Counselors Association, seems to be driving all of this indoctrination material, both sex ed, racism, and Howard Zinn-like anti-American books. Can we kick them out of Tennessee?
Well, We can and should. I think that anyone who studies this area at all is familiar with the fact that critical race theory is a Marxist curriculum. It has its core in Marxism, and so the fact is we just need to mobilize more people like the Lucentis, to step up to the plate and be courageous in opposing what is not only dangerous for their children, but it's an intrusion into the parental liberty right to control their child's education.
And anti-American. You know, I've learned since I started this podcast here in Tennessee that school boards are actually quite powerless now that the Fed money came with the strings attached. Yeah, is that right? I mean, I know the accreditation each school must have so the kids can graduate and be accepted to college is vital. Are the alternatives to private schools, NAIS, you know, 2,000 of the 2,500 American schools, they're stuck in that. Do you know of anything that would solve that, the hook that the federal agencies are putting into the schools to do their bidding?
Well, you know, if we could abolish the NEA overnight, that would certainly have an impact. The NEA is not in step with its rank and file members. And if teachers would take the initiative to vote out of leadership of that organization, those who, you know, are fostering this type of policy, that would go a long way, I think, as well. But
you're talking about my favorite person, Randy Weingarten, and I say that facetiously because she's my least favorite person. Randy Weingarten is the president of the NEA and has been forever and probably will be forever because she is elected for life, I think.
I think you're right. but, you know, we've made some inroads here in Tennessee. About 7 or 8 years ago, I was involved with a case on the part of a number of members of the TEA who said their dues shouldn't go to support political positions that they abhor or opposed to. And the court agreed.
That is the lifeblood. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, the time has come for us to be very creative in the way that we attack these programs. And I think that choosing your battles and then, as we have done in this case, line up your experts. We've got two very good experts in this Parents' Choice case. James Lindsay, who's a celebrated author and researcher in this area, and also Jennifer McWilliams, a parents' rights specialist. So I predict that there will be some momentum on this issue nationally. And, you know, with the presidential election looming ahead and it's on us, we may see this become an issue like it did in Virginia.
Oh, that'd be great. And so back here at home, Senate Majority Leader Jack Johnson has an anti-drag queen law now and an anti-body mutilation for minors bill, like we learned Vanderbilt was doing. Rep. Reagan from Oak Ridge was on here, and he and Senator Janice Bowling had bills in 2018 to stop this. It would have stopped this. I wasn't around then to see, but did you know about the bill that would have saved victims, and are you working with any of them to sue Vanderbilt for damages? I know that's your alma mater, so maybe a little sensitive, but they are the ones in the news. And it's tricky because, like your pharmacist case, free speech, First Amendment, religious liberties goes both ways, doesn't it? What we don't like is perverted drag shows, they say, is art, so the lawyers get involved.
Well, again, and I have sued Vanderbilt, by the way, over the years. I think that this is another area where we have to, lawyers who do constitutional work oftentimes deal with this concept of characterization and how you characterize your case. It may be that your strongest argument is free speech argument, or it may be that it's free exercise or a combination of the two in some hybrid case. But I was approached concerning the issue involving the mutilation that's been going on at my alma mater, sadly.
Mine's worse, so I feel for you. Yeah.
Well, and I applaud Jack Johnson for doing his work in this area. It's vital because oftentimes there's a legislative approach to dealing with the issue that can prove more successful than litigation. So it needs there needs to be both. But I think that I'm strongly behind those bills. We'll see what comes of them. But
We're currently in the pause for Vanderbilt and their surgeries, but you know, so did Harpeth Hall with allowing biological males to apply to the all-girls private school, but now they are allowing them after the pause. Do you think Vanderbilt will resume after their pause? A lot of money on the table, sadly.
Yeah, it is. And sadly also, just I think philosophically, it seems to be the direction Vanderbilt is headed. I live about 5 blocks from Harpeth Hall, and I was appalled when I heard the news about that school. But you know, I had parents last week from a school called Battleground Academy.
I'm 5 blocks from that one. Yeah,
are you? Yeah. So you know, I mean, it's been a bastion over the years, a great school. It's turned out some great leaders, but as a private school, they were in their AP classes, AP literature classes, teaching, from materials that were just graphically inappropriate.
That's the National Association of Independent Schools. Everybody thinks if they have the means to get them out of public school and put them in a private school, they'll be safe and this won't be their problem. It'll be somebody else's problem, but it's not true. The NAIH, which is looking for a new president, is almost as bad, and it's worse because it's the private schools, it's the Catholic schools, it's the Protestant schools, it's the type of school that would allow Notre Dame to demand boosters for their kids for the 2023 school year. So I just think everything has become a negotiation. You know, your client is called Parent Choice. I'm surprised more parents aren't up in arms over all this nonsense. Well, nonsense to me, maybe not to their kids and their families going through these traumas, but I'd like to know if you were overwhelmed with moms and dads joining your case or not? And are the parents and donors at places like Harpeth in favor of this or disgusted?
We packed the courtroom last week. Now I've learned from my experience that if you're in state court, sometimes that can be an influence on the judge. Not so much in federal court, who are appointed for life. They could care less who's in the courtroom. But the judge more than once kind of made a hinting pass to the fact that the courtroom was full of concerned parents. And I've got to believe that if this were brought more to the forefront, more parents across the state would be behind Parents' Choice.
I think so too. I know you have to be careful because you work with these folks, but how do you think AG Scarmetti is doing on the job so far?
I think Scarmetti's doing a good job. Personally, I think, there needs to be, I think there need to be more. We attack this issue from different perspectives, but, I can't say anything bad about it.
I've been watching Missouri versus Biden very closely. This is the case where Missouri is suing Biden, Fauci for First Amendment violations for secretly coordinating with social media companies like Facebook and Twitter to punish wrong thinking Americans. Think he'll join it?
I think so. Sometimes I think the state of Texas has been leading the charge so often on these kinds of cases. I'm glad to see Missouri is doing something as well now, but what has brought this more to public attention has been Elon Musk and Twitter. With whether or not there should be any type of censorship of Facebook, which is of course and social media that's become kind of the public square now for expression of ideas. I'll be teaching a course in January in Colorado dealing with that very issue of how and when people are subject to discipline or being fired over their social media comments.
That is a state that could definitely use you. I saw the longest serving and last Democrat, I believe, Supreme Court Justice in Tennessee is retiring. How did you find her, and are you up for the nomination?
I wish I were, but our Supreme Court has been surprisingly led over the last few years, not only by women, but some very left-leaning women, and who before they became judges, I had litigated against a number of times and formed good professional relationships with, despite our difference on the political spectrum. But it's time to get some fresh blood up there.
She really ruled with the 3-2 majority that life sentence for minors is unconstitutional, even for homicide. Apparently, Tennessee is, or I guess was, an outlier when everyone else is 50 years max. You know anything about that?
I'm not really that familiar or tuned into that issue. I'm working right now with a group called Men of Valor. You may have heard of that organization. They deal with reentry for men coming out of prison. It's a Christian organization, and they're being called on the carpet about whether they can inquire of men who come into their program about their sexual orientation or past drug abuse and use and so forth, and whether as a religious organization they're exempt from the requirements of the Fair Housing Act and other federal laws. But that's an interesting issue, I think. That's certainly relevant right now, given what is going on in Congress, and we just saw in the Senate with the Defense of Marriage.
In my former state, Washington, the governor had emergency powers for almost 1,000 days, even with counties where there was zero COVID. The legislature was happy to give away their checks and balances. How did Lee in Tennessee handle emergency power authorization in the COVID era?
Well, there you got to understand that our statute, which kind of was enacted or broadened as a result of this horrific flood that we had back in, I want to say, 2005. Or whenever it was in Tennessee and in the Nashville area, it granted and delegated to our executive very broad powers. Our governor essentially had under that statute the ability to do everything but stop the sale of arms under our Emergency Powers Act in Tennessee. So I remember being asked to speak at the legislature on that issue and whether or not the General Assembly had any power to rein in the governor under our statute, and looked at the statute in Washington and Alaska and other states to kind of give a comparison of how those states did impose some stopgap measures on the governor. I don't think that Governor Lee himself went at this COVID pandemic with the view of I'm going to assert my power in an abusive or tyrannical way. I think the issue was whether or not his power had been delegated further down the line to local authorities, and whether or not they, in particular, like Williamson County, were being very draconian in the way that they were enforcing those mandates.
Right. We talked about that, how they went beyond with the masks when the rest of the state had said no more. Yeah,
precisely.
Public place accommodations, the next section I want to talk about. Can you explain that and how that affected the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Well, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we have here in Tennessee, the Tennessee Human Rights Act, all require that places of public accommodation, restaurants, hotels, et cetera, do not discriminate on the basis of one's race, color, sex, creed, sexual orientation now. The issue oftentimes revolves around whether or not an individual who is insistent on public display of their, let's say, sexual identity in a way that would be offensive, let's say, to people who have more conservative views of how people in those places should display openly their proclivities. But I, you know, it that is an area where it's extremely difficult to say that you or I should be allowed to exercise our view of what is permissible. I know I'm trying to think of the best example right now. In the practice of law, the ABA is trying to promulgate a rule now that would apply to all states that have adopted ABA guidelines that lawyers cannot turn away a case. Even if they disagree with the person's, position, if they do so on the basis of their, sexual identity or sexual orientation or whatever.
So this is sort of like the baker, right? This is the baker who doesn't want to bake the cake for the lesbian wedding, or the artisan doesn't want to be forced to have to do their art if they don't agree with the religious or that. But it also applies to the ability for a restaurant or a hotel to say, you can't come in here without us violating your HIPAA law by telling us what your vaccine status is, flying on an airplane, any of these type of things too, right? Doesn't it also apply there?
And it does.
So I guess the question is, do we win or lose that in Tennessee? And are there any laws coming up in the next legislature that will strengthen our bodily integrity rights or loosen them that you know of? Sure.
I'm unaware of any proposed bills at this time, but there, this is something that our legislature should look at because I suspect, although I don't know, that in the vast majority of counties in Tennessee, with the exception of perhaps Shelby and Davidson, and maybe Hamilton, that the public sentiment would be behind those bills. I have the misfortune of living in Davidson County, and I'm kind of an island unto myself here. Nonetheless,
you're saying the voters may actually be on the other side, where they would be more inclined to say, yes, you can make sure they mask.
Yeah, I think you're
absolutely right. Yeah, that's the slippery slope. You would think that common sense would win out, but it doesn't always. But I do think religious liberties is very important, and obviously you do too. You made a career out of it, but they didn't honor it the last few years. So something stronger is needed. I wrote a 2-sentence amendment to the county charter from the last place I lived, and the majority leader said she didn't agree with the language, but it didn't matter because, only once every 7 years can it be amended, the charter. But Tennessee is different. Tennessee is supposed to be the registered red state. And it's not good in an emergency against the government overreaching. Could a bodily integrity bill pass here so nobody can force anyone to wear a mask or vaccine them without informed consent, like the Nuremberg Code says?
I don't think that's too far a stretch. I think that right now, we, at least from the midterms, we've got a very red General Assembly in Tennessee. And even here in Davidson County, we saw a person elected that was Republican, which is unheard of.
Unheard of, yeah. And they just created, a new one. So we have one, Christopher Richards, who we just interviewed as well. Maybe I'll email him this 2 sentences and see if he can push it forward, because it's time. If not now, when? But the pharma lobby is very strong in Tennessee, and I think 10 Republicans killed a bill to opt out of immunizations for religious beliefs. It failed. One rep had 30% pharma money support and voted against it, and there were other bills too, like masks and gatherings. Okay, that's a constitutional amendment. Did the reddest of red states not come through on those?
Well, it didn't, and in part, I think, because you have... at least the time I was before the legislature to speak about that issue, there were a number of people in education that were, expressing horror stories about their children being exposed in the classroom. It just tended to resonate, I think, those concerns with some of the legislators.
Mm. Well, they'll pass out, prophylactics, but they don't want them to be sneezed on. It's kind of a crazy thing. But the new mandatory school vaccination list has COVID on it. New Horizons is going with a national policy, not state. How do we make sure Tennessee doesn't force this stuff on the kids? And, you know, shall we be exempt? Not be, may be exempt, shall be exempt. We need to end their product liability immunity too, don't we? No other product has that.
Yeah, I think you've got to, if you're going to make it mandatory that, or an opt-out or some provision that parents of children who they don't want exposed to that type of mandate, then you've got to have with it some type of limitation of liability or immunity on the part of the school district if those children should contract an illness like COVID or any virus and transmit it. I don't think that school districts are subject to much liability anyway.
Doesn't seem like it. Nobody sued in the last 2 years when COVID was rampant, and that's not the issue anymore. So the immunization is probably more dangerous than that. And, you know, hospitals didn't honor spouse or power of attorney visitation rights during COVID either. And they didn't prescribe.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't prescribe things that would help, like vitamin D and C and hydrating water. Are they liable?
Well, I think causation would be the issue, but if you could prove a causal connection between the failure to provide those medications, certainly there would be medical negligence liability. You know, hospitals can and should be sued when those policies result in injury or death.
I've been waiting for the class actions. I have not seen them. I don't know why, but something's preventing that from happening. You know, and the National Guard and public service employees that were all fired. What are we doing to ensure that stops and never happens again? I don't see any Republicans working on that with hearings.
Well, I don't either. And, you know, I sued the Biden administration on behalf of a number of federal contractors in the Tullahoma last year. Before the lawsuit could get resolved, the administration, revoked the mandate in response to the Supreme Court, of course. But, you know, the military and those who are federal contractors are being regarded as a category apart from the rest of the population. That's not right. It's not fair. I think military personnel ought to be the first line of people that we protect in this area.
They seem to go hand in hand here. We're talking about military personnel. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about the frontline people, the police, the fire, the EMT, the National Guard, et cetera, et cetera. They're being assumed that they've given up their rights in order to serve in those jobs, whereas everybody else, you know, American Airlines pilots, Delta pilots, same thing. They're not exactly in the government, but they have a very important job. You can't have them all passing out up there at 30,000 feet. So I don't know, when did the world decide that certain Americans don't have constitutional rights and some do just because of the job that they chose for their livelihood?
Well, there was a case Supreme Court decided a number of years ago involving a chaplain who wanted to be able to, who happened to be a Jewish gentleman and wanted to wear his yarmulke as being a military chaplain. And the military refused, and the Supreme Court essentially said the military had the right to require that he adhere to military protocol. In any other non-military setting, he would have won. But you're right. It's sad that they appear to be second class citizens when it comes to freedom of exercise of religion.
The ones that defend our constitutional rights are carved out to not have any constitutional rights. Doesn't seem very likely. And that's probably why they're having a hard time recruiting new ones, because why would anybody sign up for such a thing?
Right.
But it also seems like the state opened itself up for a lot of vaccine and constitutional violation lawsuits if a law firm wanted to build a class. I don't know. What are some of the things we should be on the lookout for in 2023?
Well, the scare that we've had with COVID, I don't think is going away. I think we're going to see, of course, more threats in terms of if the school system can use its authority in the way that we saw in the last couple of years, then they will see that as a right they can exercise in the future. We're just going to see a continued, I think, effort on the part of school boards to dictate what they think is best for your child. And so we've got to be ready. Class action suits are great, but you've got to get, you know, there are essentially four elements you've got to satisfy, and those oftentimes are difficult to find commonality among some of these parents and the reasons they oppose the mask mandate in that case or other requirements. But I think it's possible to craft that type of lawsuit. In the future, I think lawyers who go after this need to be very careful about which venue they choose and do a little, you know, the left has been doing forum shopping for years. It's time that we start doing it too.
It would be nice if Tennessee was the leader in that and our governor would take the mantle and sort of be the driver of I don't want to say the new Confederacy, that would be very bad, but the new conservative constitutional libertarian party. But I don't particularly think he is that. You are the general counsel for Tennessee Stands with Gary Humble, who I've had on this podcast. What is that and what are your priorities there?
Well, Tennessee Stands is an advocacy organization. Gary Humble, a very conscientious, outspoken constitutionalist, saw the need to form that organization a few years ago and has really done great things with it over the last several years. Gary is one of my favorite people. He's just very outspoken, but he's honest to a core. And I think oftentimes I'll get a call from Gary and he'll want to know whether or not to lead the charge in one area or another. There's just so much work to be done. And Tennessee Stands is doing, has had a good grassroots appeal. And I think that there's no reason to suspect it won't continue. If I can keep Gary out of politics long enough,
that's right.
Do what he's called to do.
We just had an election a week ago, so maybe you got a little window there until the next one. But we got about 3 minutes left with you. In 2018, you represented kids at Brentwood Academy who were falsely accused on social media of sexual assault, allegedly. We always hear, where are the parents to raise these kids, right? But how do you feel about the parents that did that to that boy? Tell us how it went down and how did it resolve?
Well, as it turns out, my personal opinion is that that lawsuit is that the mom of that young boy did a great disservice, I think, in filing that lawsuit against Brentwood Academy and making what are very serious allegations against these young boys, as it turns out, allegations that were false. And, you know, Brentwood Academy took a hard blow from all of that notoriety. And I think it's unfortunate because that school has done a great work and continues to do a great work. It's a good example of what can come when a parent makes those kinds of incendiary allegations against a Christian school.
Yeah. And the Holland family, they have a Down syndrome child, and you won a precedent-setting ruling with the National Down Syndrome Society. Can you tell us a little about that major case in just a minute?
Sure. Adam Holland is my hero, as a matter of fact. He's a young boy who is on the severe autistic spectrum, or Down syndrome spectrum, rather. he basically had the misfortune of having his face or image used and cropped and published on some very disturbing social media. It went viral, internationally viral. And so he, you know, my the few times I've had the pleasure of representing Down syndrome children is they are always innocent. They're always smiling. They're always, there's this just angelic quality to them. And to see that young man have to learn that his face had been put on some very ugly posters and made fun of as retarded and so forth, horrible things said about him. I think the jury took sympathy with him and did the right thing. And so he's flourishing now, doing well, and it was a great case.
All right. Well, it's not often said in the same sentence, but you are a great man and a great lawyer. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. We are at the end of our time here. So please tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, Tennessee Stands, Parents Choice Tennessee, and whatever else you're interested in.
Well, thank you, Steve. I by all means, you can contact me certainly through Crane Law at Legal, CraneLawLegal.com. And if you want to contact our office or Tennessee Stands, just you can generally find us through Google very easily. It's just TennesseeStands.com, I think, is the website. But in any event, I'm sure that you have our email and phone contact information, certainly if anyone contacts you, and our doors are open.
Absolutely.
So everyone have a blessed Thanksgiving, and I'll catch you next time.
I would do that in a heartbeat, and I hope to have you on again. Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving once again.
Thank you.
God bless. I don't Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on our minds. Steve, what did you think of constitutional lawyer Larry Crane?
Well, I made a few points, and I just want to say that he knows his stuff. He's a champion for the small guy, and you need more people like Larry Crane on your side when you're going against the machine. And the machine is any entity who wants to remove our freedoms, who wants to go against the things of God, and who are pushing evil, quite frankly, evil. And you need more Larry Cranes. He was part of the Rutherford Institute. Anybody who needs to, check them out. They're a wonderful outfit as well. There's, Steve, I've found out about a dozen, or I should say about a half dozen organizations. We got one up here in Snohomish County that's working, that you know of, your friend. What's his name that does similar work up here in Washington?
Pete Serrano at the Silent Majority Foundation.
Silent Majority.
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly right. He is our Tennessee version of that, and been around long enough to know where the bodies are buried, who to work with, and how to get things done.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, moving on. Someone knew what we were going to be getting into in the 2022 elections before anyone else, and had he lived, would not have been surprised by the red puddle we got instead of the red wave, as advertised. Let's go back in time and hear from Radio Hall of Famer and Medal of Freedom winner Rush Limbaugh. Please play clip one.
To cheating. There are gazillions of Americans who've bought into this. There are lots of Americans who have gone over to the dark side. This is not simply because the Democrats fraudulently stole an election. Even if they did, they still got, plugs still got enough votes to enable them to go over the line by cheating. We have a serious problem here. But the idea that the American people didn't know what they were doing and in 2 years are going to be running to the ballot box to reverse their decision because they had no idea they were electing a bunch of communists. What do you think just happened in Georgia? Two known communists were elected knowingly. How did it happen? Georgia has been overrun by people leaving the Northeast There were stories all over the news about how Democrats were being targeted to move to Georgia to establish residency there for the singular purpose of electing these two communists to the Senate. And they did it. So the idea that we are in the midst of a traditional American politics, I think, I mean, while it would be great if it's true, it's woefully naive. It misses the point of what is happening right in front of our faces in this country.
So, speaking of Americans,
we're gonna going to sweep over... them in 2022, man.
Go ahead.
Here Steve. we have a story in Georgia. So he knew a dad works his whole life, created an auto loans company in 1972 and retires in 2017. Auto industry leaders described Donald Foss as an entrepreneurial icon who epitomized the American dream. American success story. So successful at capitalism, he's named to Forbes' billionaire list in 2022 with $2 billion. Wow, right? I mean, that's good. To provide for and support for his family, twice married, a divorce will certainly set you back, but three children. One he cared for so much, he put her in a $60,000 a year private Georgia college taking African American studies, and grew up in a $7.3 million home in Franklin, Michigan. Father of the year, right, Steve?
Yep.
Let's hear how Donald Foss's little girl, but probably the apple of his eye, spoke about him at his funeral. He died at 78 from cancer.
Wow.
Play the clip.
But Dad, please know that while I am grateful and highly aware of all that you've given this family, I still don't miss you. When you died, I felt like there was a hole. I missed something, but it wasn't you. It was the idea of what you could become. I miss being able to hope and wish that one day you turn a corner and see the world from my perspective. I miss the idea that one day you might help me fight for the things that matter. I missed my fantasy of you. Because when you died, it solidified the fact that you'll never be what you could have been, but only what you are. And what you are is a racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, Trump-loving, cis-straight white man. That is all you will ever be to me. And Dad, before you tell me to respect the dead, please remember that you disrespected and disregarded the lives and deaths of entire communities of people with your ideology. You told me to never back down, so I won't. You know for a fact that even against you, I'm not afraid to share my peace. You are everything I aspire not to be, and I refuse to stand up here and sing the praises of a man who is the paradigm of white supremacy. So I'll take your racist mindset, I'll take your money, and I'll take your advice. And I swear to God I will make this world a better place, not at all because of you, but in exact opposition to you.
Did you hear that? Called racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, Trump-loving, cis-straight white man by his own biracial daughter. Foss remarried to Constance, Samantha, age 19, who you just heard from, her mother. She goes by they, them. Those are her pronouns. And a self-described black supremacist. Steve, before I ask you a question, I just want to read something to you. 2 Timothy chapter 3. This known also that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. What form of government, Steve, demands kids denounce their parents and God?
Communism.
What did Rush Limbaugh say was going to happen in the 2022 election that we didn't elect not one, but two of?
Communism.
One last question. What market does a subprime car finance company, in this case, credit acceptance, serve?
Poor.
Uh-huh. So Don's legacy in the automobile industry spans 55 years, beginning in 1967, when he opened his first car lot in Detroit, and began selling primarily to customers who did not qualify for traditional financing. Foss created the Don Foss Annual Scholarship in 1998 and Don Foss Endowed Scholarship in 2015, which have awarded more than 630 scholarships to students pursuing careers in the automotive industry at Northwood University. In 2016, he established a private fund, Car Dealers Care National Foundation, which gives back to the community through his personal philanthropy and CarRight, a chain of dealerships he founded in 2011. We just heard her say her father was everything I aspire not to be. I think she even knows all that about him.
I would have had him on a podcast that I used to do, that we were doing about cars and automotive. We need that kind of individual to sponsor young men and young women who want to go in the automotive industry. There's a huge need for that. And just some of the things you've told me, hearing about, and then you listen to a girl. I think you see a girl who is immensely confused. I don't know what his schedule was. Maybe she's just totally screaming out vindictive. Maybe in a couple of years, she's going to wake up and she's going to cry her eyes out and recognize what a pathetic individual she's become, and she will finally realize she misses her daddy. But right now, I think she's taken that loss. She's zeroing in, and she's going to be a champion for everything evil. And my prayer is that she will come to her knees, fall on the ground, and cry out.
I hope so, and I hope Jesus finds her. Trump's Republican support plummets by 20 points. New poll shows Donald Trump is very unpopular in the polls, CNN Politics. For example, a Gallup poll conducted in January 2021 showed that 34% of Americans approved of Trump's job performance, while 62% disapproved. Play the last clip for me, please.
Trump's done. Donald Trump's done. He's done. There's no question about that. He's done.
Breaking news.
A bombshell.
Today is a turning point. Today was historically bad for President Trump.
Today was a turning point.
A turning point.
We're at a turning point here.
The beginning of the end for the Trump presidency.
The beginning of the end.
And breaking news.
We have another bombshell.
Mike Pence might have to assume the office of the presidency.
The call for impeachment.
Rumblings of the word impeachment.
Breaking news.
Another bombshell out of the White House.
I believe this is the beginning of the end.
I do too.
It's really the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end.
He may be feeling the walls closing in on him.
All the walls closing in on him.
The walls closing in on him.
Breaking news, a new bombshell.
One astrologer says this means the beginning of the end for President Donald Trump.
The beginning of the end of the Trump presidency.
Trump will resign.
Trump is going to resign.
Is this the tipping point? I know we've said it.
There you go. So, Steve, do you think they will finally do him in, or is he the comeback, comeback, comeback kid?
You know, I don't know. To be honest, I'm not following him. But the fact is, when you watch that blurb of all these, you know, Steve, they get talking points. That's what you call propaganda. They get a talking point, and every single news channel out there says the same identical thing. Those talking heads, they do not know how to think for themselves, Steve. They are reading a teleprompter, and whatever's put up there, I think it was one of our past shows, you kind of said, when the flight went down. The fact is, these people are brainwashed. They're with glee, and they just say, oh, it's going to happen. And, you know, Steve, we need to just flush all that out. Go back to focusing on what Rush was talking about and what your guest was talking about. We need to be grassroots level, getting involved with our local politics, getting to know the candidates, and pushing and going out and activating true patriots, be they Christian or not. And that's going to be the answer. Enough people to raise up.
Tune in here, and you're going to hear from a whole bunch more. And stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to our Thought of the Week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere really now, and hit the subscribe button. Thank you for doing it. I no longer listen to what people say. I just watch what they do. Behavior never lies. Diplomacy is the art of telling people to go to hell in such a way that they ask for directions. Socialism is a philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery. All three of those were Winston Churchill. Another great comeback. Well, that's it for this episode. Really hoped you like it. Write to me at millcreekview@yahoo.com, and I just might read it on the air. Thank you, Larry Crane, for fighting for us and coming on my show. And until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, Managing Director of Mill Creek Financial Partners. Peace in our time.
At the county fair, they were looking for America.